everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass, and it's time for It's All About Food. Thanks for joining me. I'm really looking forward to this. Okay, I look forward to a lot of my shows, but I have to admit that this one is going to be extra special. It's difficult when people get diagnosed with a difficult disease, and more we have mountains of evidence talking about the power of a whole foods plant-based diet. We talked a few months ago with Drs. Dean and Ayesha Sherzai about the Alzheimer's solution. That was so exciting to find out that we could actually reduce the risk of Alzheimer's disease by 90%. I still can't get over that number. With a healthy diet and lifestyle, and that's a whole food plant-based diet. And we've been talking for years about how heart disease and diabetes can be prevented and very often reversed. This is really wonderful information, and unfortunately, it's taken a long time to get out there. Well, we're going to learn about one of the other debilitating diseases that also can be positively impacted by a whole foods plant-based diet. And I'll get into that in just a little bit. Back from California, and it was an interesting time to be away in California and now to be back home. It's always kind of surreal to spend time in one place and then come back to another place that you know so well, but you've been away from for a while. It's like familiar, but not familiar. But what's really familiar and the parts that I love is coming home and coming home to my kitchen, coming home to my herbs and spices, coming home to my raw nuts and seeds, and my just all the things that I love to have to put together fantastic dishes. And I'm at responsibleeatingandliving.com. I hope you've been there, but that's where we house so many of our great recipes, along with my daily blog, What Vegans Eat, so you can see real food that the vegans are eating every day. Now, one more thing I wanted to talk about before I bring on my guest is tonight we begin another plant-powered and thriving course. Have you heard about plant-powered and thriving? Have you taken plant-powered and thriving? Have you thought about taking plant-powered and thriving? This is a six-week online course that I co-created with John Robbins and his son, Ocean Robbins. And we've been doing it for about 3 years, maybe longer. And I really love it. I get really excited when we get started doing this. We have wonderful participants. It's once a week. We answer questions on the first course and after the last course. There's a very active Facebook page. And if you're having challenges transitioning or you want to take your diet up a notch, or you just want to learn the latest and greatest when it comes to food and nutritional science, this is a great course, and it's fun. And I find that John and Ocean and I, we all bring something different to the party. It's a very different balance. So if you're interested, have I sold you on it yet? If you're interested, you can go to, I'm going to give you the web address, thriving.foodrevolution.org /join, thriving.foodrevolution.org/join. Have you got that? Very good. All right. So now that you got all that important information, I'm going to bring on my first guest, Dr. Saray Stancic, MD, a graduate of UMDNJ, New Jersey Medical School, and a board-certified infectious disease specialist since 1999, is the founder of Stancic Health and Wellness in Ramsey, New Jersey. The mission of this innovative medical practice is to educate and empower patients for achieving optimal health via lifestyle modification while shedding light on the large and mounting body of scientific data supporting the importance of optimal nutrition in disease prevention. She seeks a highly personalized doctor-patient relationship, pursuing individual health-related goals, which may include weight loss and improved control of blood sugars, lipid profiles, and/or blood pressure, with an eye towards reducing dependency on medication. And there's so much more we're going to be learning about Dr. Sansik right now. Welcome to It's All About Food. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much, Karen. It's a great pleasure to be with you this afternoon.
You know, I've been trying to get you on this program for a long time. As soon as I read your story, I thought, I have to meet this person, even if it's just meeting you like this. I loved
I know.
Your story.
I wish I was with you in the studio. It would be nice to speak in person, but my schedule has been so hectic. So nonetheless, I'm happy to be here, and I'm happy to have an opportunity to chat with you.
Well, I want to hear your story, and you have a few stories. So I want to... When I first read about you, it was about your journey with multiple sclerosis. And it's such an important story to share. And I was hoping that you might tell us a little bit about it.
Sure. So my story begins 22 years ago on October 11th, 1995. I was at the time a third-year medical resident. And I was on call at Beth Israel Medical Center, and it was one of those really busy nights where my pager just wouldn't stop ringing, and I was literally running from the ICU to the emergency room and back to the general ward all night. And it wasn't until sometime between 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning in which I found a window to make it back to my on-call room to take a brief nap. And, Karen, I remember making my way there and feeling this deep-seated sense of fatigue, like something I had never experienced before. And the minute my head hit that pillow, lights out. Shortly thereafter, as you might imagine, in the midst of that very busy call, I was paged yet again to address another urgent patient matter. But this time, when I tried to get up out of that sleeping position, I couldn't feel my legs. And I remember reaching down to touch them, and it felt like they were someone else's legs. And panic set in. I was terrified. I didn't know what was happening. Next thing I knew, I was in the emergency room undergoing an MRI of my brain and spinal cord, and those studies confirmed a diagnosis of multiple sclerosis with multiple lesions in both my brain and spinal cord.
A very, very scary diagnosis, which you must have understood right away.
Oh, absolutely.
Studying medicine, yeah.
Studying medicine and obviously caring for patients with this disease, I knew what it was capable of doing. And so immediately, it was obviously a very dark period in my life, and there were obviously many concerns. I was a young woman. I had just turned 28 years old, and now I was being told by my physicians that I had this chronic disease, and there was a very good chance that in 20 years I might be in a wheelchair. And so hearing those words at that age were extraordinarily difficult moments for me. And I was admitted to the hospital at that time and started on multiple medications to treat that acute event and then other medicines to slow the progression of this chronic disabling disorder. And that's really when things became extraordinarily difficult for me because the medications, particularly the one medication that I was on, there was only one medicine approved by the FDA in 1995 for multiple sclerosis, and that was a drug called Betaseron. And it is a drug that has a significant side effect profile that includes fever, chills, muscle aches and pains, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, anorexia, insomnia, depression, suicidal thoughts, really, really significant side effects. And these drugs really took a toll on me. And what ended up happening is the side effects of that medication led to prescriptions of other drugs to treat those side effects. So when I couldn't sleep at night, I was given Ambien. When I couldn't wake up in the morning, I was given Provigil, an amphetamine-like drug. And so by the time I was in my early 30s, I was dependent on nearly a dozen drugs. So I had a pill box. And despite all of these medicines, my disease progressed and my quality of life suffered immensely.
But there's a happy ending to this, right?
There is a happy ending. About 8 years into the diagnosis, and I'll tell you, this is around 2003, and at this point, I was dependent on a crutch or cane and not doing well. I came across, just by chance, an article that discussed diet and MS. And this was extraordinary to me. I was struck by this because I had never, I mean, here I was, a physician, 4 years of medical school, 4 years of residency, and then another 2 years as a subspecialist. So 10 years of my life dedicated to higher education in the field of medicine. And I had never, none of my educators, professors, or mentors had ever connected these two dots, diet and disease. And so this was an extraordinary finding for me. And, of course, that small article in that throwaway journal really sparked a great interest in me. It was what I call my aha moment, because for the first time in my life, I connected these two possibilities. And, of course, I turned to the scientific literature looking for answers. Could this, in fact, be true? And what I found was extraordinary, that there was indeed ample evidence in the scientific literature that diet and disease were closely affiliated. And I began to study the literature very, very carefully. And at the end of the day, what I learned was that changing not only my diet, but also my lifestyle, and that is exercise, stress management, effective sleep hygiene, the avoidance of tobacco, and reduction or near elimination of alcohol, that's what we call this discipline called lifestyle medicine. When you apply all these parameters, we know, the scientific literature tells us, that we can indeed prevent nearly 80% of chronic disease and even manage and reverse many diseases by applying these principles. To me, this was an extraordinary treasure that I had come across, and I was struck because why wasn't it that I wasn't taught this in medical school? But nonetheless, I applied these things in my own life, Karen, and yes, there is a happy ending. It didn't happen in a month or in 2 months or even 6 months, but over the following period of time, over the years, I regained control of my life. I came off all of those medications, and I went from a woman that was at one point dependent on a cane to one that crossed a finish line at the New Jersey Marathon in 2010. So for me, it's been an extraordinary journey, and it's largely why today, although I'm very proud of the work that I did in the field of infectious diseases in the early part of my career, today I have fully dedicated my profession to this idea that is lifestyle medicine, because I want to spread this message. I want to share this empowerment with patients and communities and truthfully other physicians, because we need to change the way we train doctors in medical schools, and the structure of academia needs to evolve to reflect the environment that we live in today. We live in a world that is struggling with chronic diseases. Diabetes and obesity are exploding in our country, and patients are suffering. And although medicines are important and all the innovations and advances we've acquired in medicine are extraordinary, really the most important aspect, the foundation of medical care, must be prevention. It must be these variables that is lifestyle medicine, food, movement, stress management, sleep hygiene. These are really very, very important, and they need to be built into the construct of medical education.
Well, I'm sorry that you had to go through this, but I'm not saying that it was a good thing that it happened, but it's a wonderful thing what came out of all of it, because we need doctors like you so desperately with this message. I wanted to share... The reason why your particular story resonated with me so much is a couple of reasons. One, when I was a young girl, my aunt was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. This was in the 60s, and there really wasn't much for her. And she had two young children, and I watched her just dissolve physically. We couldn't understand her. She was in a nursing home. It smelled like urine. It wasn't a place that a young child wanted to be in. And it wasn't until my later years that I really felt the pain of what she went through. And when my best friend was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis around 1999, it all came back to me. And I thought, this is not going to happen to her. And I did to some extent what you did. I don't have a medical degree, so I didn't have access to all kinds of literature, but I did find out about Dr. Swank's work and a variety of other things. And I put her, she was a vegetarian who was eating bagels, pasta, and cheese, and pretzels. That was her diet.
Not a good diet.
Even though she wasn't eating meat, she was eating white flour food and dairy. And anyway, I put her on a very healthy diet, and her doctor 10 years later said, you're one of the lucky 10%.
Yeah, that's a great story. Thank you for sharing that with me. And it's so true. And it's interesting, you know, in 1952, Roy Swank published the first article in the New England Journal of Medicine speaking to this diet and disease. And at that point, he hypothesized that it was saturated fat that was playing a role in MS. And he went on to treat patients in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. He actually published the data in the Archives of Neurology in 1970 after following 140-plus patients over 20 years. But he didn't stop there, Karen. He followed them another 14 years and reported on them in the Lancet Journal in 1990. And at the end of the day, what he concluded was those patients that maintained that low-fat plant-based diet had lower rates of mortality, and 95% of them remained disability-free. That's extraordinary. And yet, that body of data, regrettably, today, modern neurology doesn't give much attention to.
It's insane. That's insane. Yeah. And they come up with these reasons that there wasn't a control group to compare. The control group is everybody.
Right, right. So Swank, that's the major criticism that Swank received was that he did not have a control. What he had was a historical control. And yes, the study wasn't perfect or, you know, the perfect design that we would like to see as scientists, but certainly the data was revealing. And it's interesting that just as the story that you just shared with us, I hear stories like this all the time. I have so many patients of mine with multiple sclerosis that will similarly tell stories of improvement. And at some point needs to be acknowledged and recognized by mainstream neurology, because I think we're doing a disservice to MS patients. And by the way, it's not that I'm saying that disease-modifying therapies are not important. They may very well be, and today we have many more than we did back in 1995. I think we have more than a dozen that are approved today. But with that said, each drug has a side effect profile. There is it's a double-edged sword. So we have to weigh out the risk-benefit of any decision we make in healthcare. And by the way, optimizing our diet and exercising and addressing all these parameters that I speak to in lifestyle medicine will serve us regardless of whether we have MS or not, right? Because just because you have MS doesn't mean that you're not at risk of developing breast cancer or heart disease or diabetes or Alzheimer's disease. And we know that diet and exercise and optimal lifestyle will help to prevent those other chronic diseases from happening. And we're now building a body of evidence that, yes, lifestyle in MS, we know, for example, that patients who maintain a healthy weight reduce their risk of developing multiple sclerosis. We know that patients who do not smoke reduce their risk of multiple sclerosis. So all of these are tied in and they're correlated. We just don't have that really impressive study that I think most mainstream neurologists want to have as something that they can point to. But these anecdotal cases are valuable, and we need to stop ignoring them.
What about reducing the amount of Pepsi we drink? My aunt back in the 60s drank a lot of Pepsi. That was the one thing I really remembered about her. She was really slim, but she drank a lot of Pepsi.
Right. It's an important topic to discuss, and my hope is, and you know, it's interesting that more and more physicians are becoming aware and they're accepting this and introducing this into their clinical practice. I can tell you that here's an extraordinary thing that when I first started my practice in 2013 that I could have never predicted. I have more than 20 patients in my practice that are also physicians, and that's extraordinary.
Wow.
And it happened. Yeah, it happened because at one point we had a patient in common, you know, a diabetic patient, an obese patient, a hypercholesterolemic patient, and that patient came to see me on several medications, still with the weight issues. And by addressing their lifestyle, addressing their diet, the weight came off, the medications came off. And then when they go back to see their doctor, the doctor says, well, what have you been doing? Oh, I went to see Dr. Stancic. She's a lifestyle medicine physician. And then they say, well, what is that? So then they call me and we have a conversation, and I empower them by sharing the evidence in the literature. The lifestyle medicine is, it's important to point, is a discipline that is fully evidence-based. So everything we speak to is supported by a mounting body of literature in peer-reviewed medical journals. So that's really, so we're not asking patients to do anything that isn't, I'm not asking patients to take supplements or any, it's all about addressing what is the construct of your plate? What is your exercise regimen like? Again, are you sleeping 8 hours? What is it your sleep hygiene like? All of these parameters that we tend to take for granted, that we don't pay much attention to, that's really the key when we optimize these parameters to not only prevention but also management and reversal of disease.
Now, the few times I've contacted you, you've always been running here and there and been very busy. And one of the things I know, in addition to your wonderful practice, you've been working on a documentary called Code Blue. Can we hear a little bit about it?
Sure. So Code Blue has been a labor of love for me over the past 2 years. I partnered with a local filmmaker, and the film is really about addressing this absurd lapse in medical education. Isn't it absurd that doctors go through 4 years of medical school and learn little to nothing about nutrition? And nutrition is the most important aspect of health, maintenance and preventing disease. And we just don't get this education. We don't get any of these lifestyle matters discussed. And so what we learn in medical school is we're really good at diagnosing, and then we're really good at treating, and we typically treat with drugs or with surgical interventions. We just don't understand the value of this aspect of healthcare. And for me, this film is really about shedding light on that and then proposing the solution. What we need to do is take a look at that curricula and rebuild it to reflect the world that we live in today, which is a world of chronic disease, obesity, diabetes. Heart disease is the number one cause of death in this country. Do you know that by addressing these parameters, the literature tells us that we can prevent nearly 80% of heart disease? That's the number one cause of death. 600,000 Americans die every year. We can save 480,000 lives by addressing these parameters. That's extraordinary. I want the public to be aware of this. I want physicians to be aware of this, because together we can do this and we can turn the tide of the chronic disease epidemic.
The public, the physicians, and the politicians, because if we've got a public that's a lot healthier, healthcare won't be as outrageously expensive as it is today.
Absolutely. But we have a long way to go. I just started a petition this past Saturday, Karen, to address a matter that has been really bugging me for years. At the medical school from which I graduated, Rutgers, New Jersey Medical School in Newark, New Jersey, in the cafeteria of that hospital, University Hospital, sits a Burger King restaurant within the cafeteria of a university hospital. And that restaurant, it is absurd that a fast food eatery would be within the tertiary care center of our state. Do you not agree? Does it make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I signed that petition, by the way. I got your email and I signed it. And so please let people know where it is so that they can sign it too.
Thank you so much. It's on my Facebook page, and we're trying to share it as best we can. I think we've collected somewhere around 600 signatures, and we started on Saturday. We really want the administrators, the CEO, and the board of directors at University Hospital to understand that this is unacceptable, and it is absurd that we have this type of food environment in a place that is supposed to represent healing. I mean, what kind of message are we offering those that work, the employees of University Hospital, the medical students of Rutgers University Medical School, the residents, the physicians that work there, the community that works in, that entrusts University Hospital with their mission and their vision to offer optimal healthcare and offer an optimal environment. You know, when we know better, we have to do better. Back when I was in medical school, you know, it was acceptable to smoke in the hospital. In fact, my mentor, it's true, my mentor who's not so much older than I am, she told me when she was a resident, they used to smoke on rounds. So imagine if you walked into a hospital today and you saw a physician smoking, you would find that unacceptable. Well, today, selling cheeseburgers that are laden with saturated fat and sodium, fueling heart disease and cancer and chronic diseases, that's unacceptable. So now that we know better, we must do better. But it's 2017, and there it sits. And enough is enough. We need to bring to the attention of those that make decisions, and we as a community need to ask better. And by the way, it's not just Newark. It's not just university hospitals. All across the country, there are McDonald's and all types of, you know, different fast food restaurants. And again, I'm all about freedom of choice. I'm an American. But listen, if it's across the street and you decide to make that choice, that's fine. But what bothers me is that it's within the hospital setting. That's unacceptable.
Yes, and I totally agree with you. And I think this is a wonderful thing. And it's not just that one hospital, but it's all over the country. I know personally, I'm a cancer survivor, and I had advanced ovarian cancer in 2006, and I spent a lot of time in hospitals, and I had to educate the dietitians and tell them, you can't keep feeding me cancer promoting foods.
And that's extraordinary. Yeah,
they're still doing it because I visit with other people that are diagnosed as well, and I see the crap that they're serving. It's criminal, yeah, or it should be.
It is criminal. My medical students send me pictures all the time of a patient that just had heart surgery and they're eating, you know, bacon and eggs. It's just unacceptable. Things need to change, but we need to speak up because it's definitely moving in the right direction. I mean, we have some movement. But when you see examples like this, it really infuriates one because we have the knowledge today. We know the significance of this, and we can't keep quiet any longer. We really have to assure that we do better as we move forward.
I just have one more question. Have you received any like negative feedback from this information you're giving out? I know you just spoke with T. Colin Campbell, and his whole life he's been given pushback from the information he's tried to share on so many levels, and he's finally being heard. But you talk about physicians that come to you from their patients, but are some people still rolling their eyes to you?
Oh, absolutely. People roll their eyes and people say things. And sometimes people post things that on social media that are regrettable. But you know what? You have to grow a thick skin. I know I'm going, even when this film comes out, I know that there'll be criticism. But I spoke to T. Colin Campbell yesterday, and he told me all of his experiences and everything he's gone through. And thanks to him, we've made so many extraordinary leaps forward because of brave individuals like Colin Campbell and Caldwell Esselstyn and Dean Ornish and Neil Barnard, just extraordinary individuals. And we have to act. We have to speak up. And yes, you know, what is that? There's those three stages of truth, right? First, you're I forget the shot. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes, yes.
First you're ridiculed, then you're violently opposed, and then you're self-evidence, right? I think those are the three stages of truth, and that's okay. And I'm willing to take that beating because I believe in this so passionately, and I know that we can save lives and we can offer patients better quality of life, and so that's a battle worth fighting for. So I'm ready.
Dr. Stancic, it was delightful meeting you today here on It's All About Food. Just let us know, where can we find you and hear more about Code Blue?
Sure. So our website is codebluedocs.com. So doc is that double entendre, doc documentary. And on that website, you'll find we are trying to raise a little bit of money to get us through post-production. So if anybody is willing to donate, it's a tax-deductible donation. We're running that Indiegogo campaign until November 17th. Any little bit helps, and we are so grateful. We hope to premiere the film in the fall of 2018, and I'm so excited. We will have a premiere in New York City, so Karen, you'll have to join us. And then our hope is to have multiple premieres across the country in major cities. So hopefully many of your viewers will be able to join us.
Absolutely. I'll be there. Thank you so much for joining me today on It's All About Food.
Have a great evening. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Okay, bye-bye. All right, let's move on. Was that wonderful? That was Dr. Sarai Stancic, and I hope you follow her and look for that documentary. Isn't that wonderful news? Did you know that multiple sclerosis can actually be treated with whole plant foods with great success? I mean, how many people know that? Please share that news. Share this podcast. It's so important. Okay, now with my next guest, because we want to eat all of those wonderful plant foods, where are they going to come from? And Ben Hartman, my next guest, is going to tell us a little bit more. He's got a new book out, The Lean Farm Guide to Growing Vegetables. And Ben grew up on a corn and soybean farm in Indiana and graduated college with degrees in English and philosophy. Ben and his wife, Rachel Hirschberger, own and operate Clay Bottom Farm in Goshen, Indiana, where they make their living growing and selling specialty crops on less than 1 acre. Their food is sold locally to restaurants and cafeterias, at a farmer's market, and through a community-supported agriculture CSA program. The farm has twice won Edible Michiana's Reader's Choice Award. The Lean Farm, Ben's first book, won the Shingos Institute prestigious Research and Professional Publication Award. In 2017, Ben was named one of 50 emerging green leaders in the United States by Grist. Welcome to It's All About Food. Ben, how are you today?
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm well.
I'm glad. I'm glad. I really enjoyed reading your book, and I read it rather quickly. So at some point when I'm ready to start my farm, this is going to be my guide. It's amazing.
Hey, thank you. Appreciate it.
But I guess because you have degrees in English, that helps. That helps
sure.
You write books.
Never hurt.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I have an engineering background, and
okay.
I love systems and organization. And I know a lot of us, when we think about the earth and plants growing things, it all seems to some degree mysterious and to some degree difficult to control. Unfortunately,
uh-huh.
The last 50 to 75 years, industrial agriculture has been trying to control the environment and growing plants with
uh-huh.
all kinds of toxic chemicals and stuff. But you've come up with a plan that is sustainable and intelligent,
mm-hmm.
and you can actually make some money.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I think the local food movement is at a point where there actually is some real money in it, if you take the right approach. And I try to outline that approach in the books. And it's true, I mean, as you probably know, the lean system began in manufacturing.
Yep.
And we're kind of taking it out of the factory and putting it onto the farm. And to be honest, one of the reasons, it was a CSA customer of ours who approached us and asked if we would be interested in trying out this lean system on a farm. And he runs a factory, aluminum trailer company. And to be honest, we told him thanks, but no thanks. And part of the reason is factory methods on farms haven't always turned out sustainable results. In fact, it's led to less sustainability. And the other thing is I told him, imagine running your factory without a roof over your head. There's just too much volatility out here. We can't systematize anything, much less the lean system. However, in the end, we said yes. And the reason is really at the heart of it, lean is about identifying waste and eliminating it from your system and then delivering precisely what your customer wants and identifying what your customer wants and really listening and taking your customer seriously. And we had to admit that we actually did have a lot of waste on our farm. And there was a lot of room for improvement. And so we said, okay, we'll try it and see what happens. And so we tweaked the system. It's not every piece of the lean system fits just perfectly on a farm. However, the basic concept of identifying your waste and getting rid of the waste has really given us a boost in profits and has made our farming easier to do.
This idea of waste and reducing waste is more profitable and also saves you time. is very powerful, especially now where most of us, not everyone, is talking about climate change. And according to drawdown.org, waste, food waste, is the third topic they list that can have the most dramatic improvement on climate change by reducing food waste. And we lose food at so many different steps, but the biggest place we lose food is on the farm. And when you can be better at that, it's also going to help improve our environment.
Absolutely. I mean, as you might know, the U.S. Department of Ag estimates that 20% of fresh fruits and vegetables that are produced are never even harvested, and they never even leave the fields. And also, the agriculture as a sector, as an industry, it contributes more to fossil fuel pollution than any other industry. And so we have a lot on our shoulders here in the ag industry to take this seriously and to reduce the amount of fossil fuel consumption and amount of waste on our farms.
Yes. So.
And really, it's good for us, too. It's good for farmers. It's not just good for everyone else living on planet Earth. It really does help your bottom line to cut out the waste and make sure every seed turned into cash, that you're not wasting any effort.
And I was fascinated by so many different steps that you looked at, well, just about every step in your process, and found ways to make things more efficient and faster. There was one line I remember. I'm trying to remember what it was with respect to, but you said the work is tedious, but should not be mindless. That applies to everything we do in life. I mean, so many things are routine and difficult and challenging, but so important to be mindful about everything that we do, and the discovery can be amazing.
Yeah, and I think actually that is that's one of the side benefits of applying lean to a business is that it declutters your working environment and it makes it more easy to slip into a state of flow where you can focus on the work at hand, and it results in happiness. Research shows that the most productive and the happiest workers, whether they're on farms or in other places, are workers who have just what they need in front of them and no more. And when you can get rid of the clutter, get rid of everything you don't need, and you can focus, even it still can be hard work. I don't want to say it's not. You know, sometimes hard work on a farm. However, you can focus and you can enjoy your work more.
Now, you've taken a lot of knowledge from the Japanese. I imagine that some of their skills come from a great need for not having a lot of land and needing to be able to grow as efficiently as they possibly could.
Yeah, that's true. And countries like South Korea and Japan, their small farming community is decades ahead of ours here. And part of the in fact, many of the tools that we use come from those countries and the methods and techniques. And the reason is, like you say, they have not had access to large tracts of land. They've had to maximize every square foot in order to feed their growing populations. And actually, this is at the heart of the lean system, because the first workers at Toyota were rice farmers, and they brought this very lean thinking, and Toyota is considered a model of the lean system, an originator of the lean system. And so these rice farmers brought this very lean, no-waste way of thinking onto the factory floor. And at the time, just after World War II, when Toyota began, it was a challenging environment to be an automobile manufacturer, because the country had just been bombed out, and no one was purchasing vehicles in Japan, and there are no stable suppliers for parts. It was a very difficult time to begin an automobile business. However, they said, we're going to do it anyhow, and then they said, we want to catch the productivity of U.S. auto workers within 3 years. And so they set about applying this rice farm thinking to the factory And they within a couple of decades, they had outpaced every other auto manufacturer and became the world's number one auto manufacturer. And at that
my first car was a Toyota.
Okay, great. And it lasted a long time, probably.
It did. Absolutely.
So Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, sent a team of researchers over in the 1980s to figure out just what the heck is going on. And that team really codified the lean system and explained it in such a way that other businesses such as ours could use it and implement it.
One of the things I love about it is that it takes into consideration that nothing is stagnant. Everything changes, and you have to consistently go with the flow and change along with it.
Yeah, change is the one thing that's constant in the lean system. And the idea is that it's not just to make your work interesting. It's we change because we're imperfect, and there is always a better solution. And if you think you've found the solutions, the final solutions, then you're probably ready to be shown the door. Because there are no final solutions. There are only intimations of perfection. And the lean, they say perfection is the goal. You want to produce with zero waste, absolutely no waste in your system. And that's obviously unattainable. There's always some waste going to creep in one way or the other. However, if that's what the goal is, then you can always come closer.
Mm-hmm.
And so we found every year we grow using different methods, and the pace of change is very quick on our farm. We're constantly finding new techniques, new methods, and new processes, and it keeps our farm interesting and it makes it more profitable.
And did I read this right? Do you move around what you grow over different parts? You don't always grow the same things in the same plot?
Yeah, that's true. There is quite a bit of rotation. Mm-hmm.
And why do you do that?
The idea behind that is we want one of the principles of lean is full capacity production. And so you want to be using every square foot of your factory or every square inch of your greenhouse. And so what we do is when we see a space that is not used, when a plot becomes open, we work very quickly to put a crop in. And so as soon as we harvest, for instance, say we have a bed of 300 head lettuce, within a couple of hours, we're going to plant some beets or something else in that space. And so we're constantly at full capacity production, and there's no space that's ever open for very long. And just by virtue of following that principle, a crop gets shifted around quite often.
You cover so many different things. You have one chapter on weed and pest control, and this is a big issue, especially for those of us who want organic food. You grow organically, but you also use organic certification approved methods to handle pests and weeds. And I liked a number of times in the book when you talked about certain methods that people do. You always ended up finding that you liked the methods that seemed to work best were the ones where there was planning and like preventative stuff ahead of time rather than having to fix something later on.
Yeah. And in general, if we want successful, say, tomatoes, successful tomato harvest in August, then really the planning for that begins in the previous August, about a year ahead, with soil preparation, with making sure the infrastructure pieces are in place. And obviously with listening to customers, make sure we're growing the right type of tomatoes, right color of tomatoes. In that way, farming is unique because most crops that we grow take at least 2 to 3 months and sometimes more. And so it's a relatively slow turnaround compared to, say, a furniture factory, where they can produce a table or something in an afternoon. And so we have this very slow turnaround period, and I think it means that we have to work extra hard to plan ahead.
Speaking of tomatoes, you talked about the difference between heirloom, hybrid, and heritage tomatoes. Can you explain that to all of us who don't really know for sure?
So basically an heirloom tomato would be a tomato whose seeds have been passed through the generations. So these are older traditional varieties. And generations ago, they used to actually breed tomatoes for their foot. Hard to believe, isn't it? And now modern tomato breeders in general are looking for, they want a tomato that ships. So they want a hard outer shell.
Mm-hmm.
And they usually want a pretty regular looking tomato. You don't want too many funky colors and shapes. And so these older tomatoes actually taste really good. On the other hand, the heirloom tomatoes, they also tend to be very disease resistant. And so a hybrid tomato would be a newer type of tomato that is bred, like I said, to ship and for uniformity.
Hmm.
And then so a newer type of tomato would be these heritage tomatoes. And a heritage tomato would be a hybrid tomato that harkens back towards heirloom tomatoes. And so there are newer type tomatoes that are more disease resistant. However, they have the color and flavor that the heirloom tomatoes used to have. And so we grow a mix of all three types, depending on what our customer is asking for.
Right. Now back to weed and pest control, because I was going somewhere and then I kind of went somewhere else.
Okay.
But the point I was trying to make was when you plan, like you plan for tomatoes or you plan for so many other things on your farm, when you plan, you can significantly reduce the number of pests and weeds that are growing throughout rather than having to apply something unpleasant to get rid of them later on, right?
That's correct. And so essentially with weed management, the analogy I like to use is like someone building a house, like a carpenter building a house. You're going to tackle that project with as many tools, with a whole vanload of tools, truckload of tools. And so with weed management, I think it helps to have a lot of tools at your disposal. And it's a complicated subject. There are a lot of ins and outs, and it depends on the crop that's going in. However, a general rule that we use is if a crop is in the ground 2 months or more, and so these would include tomatoes or peppers, these long season crops, we're going to use some type of a mulch, either a plastic mulch or a natural mulch like leaves or straw. And then if it's a shorter season crop, 2 months or less, then we cultivate those crops by hand. And then another, probably the most effective way that we have eliminated weeds from our farm is simply to transplant everything. We do very little direct seeding of crops. Most of our crops go in when they're between, 4 to 6 weeks of age. And that means they're also 4 to 6 weeks ahead of the weeds. And so we can get a jump on them. And that really cuts out on the weeding we have to do.
Now, I imagine a lot of these techniques that you have developed can apply to any size farm or even someone's garden.
I mean, the reason is that the types of weeds that the Lean System has identified, they're ubiquitous. And we actually have Rachel and I have a home garden at home. And those types of weeds are in our home garden. They're in the kitchen. they're in the garage. They're everywhere. And they're in all kinds of work environments. And so there's wading waste. There's wasted motion. And the book outlines the 10 types. And so it's true that the techniques the vegetable growing techniques that we use on a scale of about half an acre, and so you can certainly use every technique in there on a home garden too.
Your farm is called Clay Bottom Farm, and you talked about how the soil is clay actually. And you have these tables and things about the different types of soils you can have to farm in. But I was surprised because I never thought you could grow anything in clay.
It's a double-edged sword because it's very difficult to work. It's obviously it sticks to your tools. It's very hard to transplant into it. However, clay holds so much nutrient that you need to add very little fertility to it. And basically what we did is we added lots of leaves, lots of grass clippings, lots of pasture cuttings, lots of organic mulch, and made a lot of compost. And we added that and mixed it in, and that really loosened it and made it a workable soil. And we've been very happy with it.
You have two young children now, right?
That's correct, yeah. One and three.
One and three. And they're out there helping out on the farm.
I mean, I would use the word help in quotes, like air quotes.
Because there were some pretty cute pictures in your book.
so we absolutely love and adore our kids. And one of the many benefits of leaning up our property and our farm, the one that I am proudest of is that it frees up a couple days a week that I can spend with our kids.
And you can even take a vacation.
And that we have plenty of time for vacations. We went on 5 camping trips last year with them. And
oh my goodness!
It's an absolute joy to farm with kids, as long as we have the time and the energy to be with them.
You also talk about how you decide what you're going to grow, and you, to some extent, you let your customers lead you or pull you. I think the term was. So. What are the trends right now? What are the customers demanding?
Most people in the U.S. now eat outside of the home most of the time. It's a minority of foods that we eat that are prepared in the home. And so what's trending is foods that are prepared, which means that sales to restaurants are really booming right now, especially these artisan restaurants. And even we've noticed in the last, 5 or 6 years in our business, our sales to restaurants went from about 15% to 20% to the point where you sell most of our food now, more than 50% goes to restaurants. And so what that means is we're doing a lot of listening to chefs. And usually what I do is every winter I'll go in and I'll talk with each of our chefs. And actually, Rachel and I try to eat a meatball in each of the restaurants that we deliver to. And we're observing the menus, and I'm asking the chef, hey, what's new on the menu next year? And could I buy seeds that would, could we plant crops that would complement what you're doing? And I can offer some suggestions, too. But in general, we take their lead and really try to listen closely. And according to Lean, there's basically three questions that you need to ask your customer. Number one is what do you want? What specific product you're after? Number two is when do you want it? And the third is how much do you want? So very simple. It's not very difficult to get answers to these questions. However, it does take a little extra effort. And we found that very simple technique is to go to each of our customers, each of our chefs, and ask them a version of these three questions. And then we fill a calendar out for the coming year. And we follow their orders. We get them what they want, when they want it, and the right amount throughout the growing season. And the closer we are to answering and delivering on those questions precisely, then the more profitable we are at the end of the year. And that's basically our farm system.
Okay, so what did they ask for last winter?
Fennel is kind of a crop that's becoming more popular because it has a lot of uses. For instance, we have a microbrewery that shreds their fennel and puts it on their hamburgers. And there's another restaurant that makes a fennel slaw. And so it's like a coleslaw that's half fennel. And there's another restaurant actually that's roasting it. They'll cut it into little half-inch, little French fry shapes, and they'll roast it. And it's a very wonderful side dish.
Wonderful. I lived in the south of France in the early 90s, and fennel is very popular in French cuisine. So I guess the American chefs are figuring that out now.
And another one that's becoming more popular is rhubarb. And it's rhubarb's an older traditional vegetable. However, there's so much you can do with it, including drinks. There are some traditional rhubarb drinks that some places are starting to use. And then obviously desserts, a whole range of desserts and other fruits you can mix it with.
And what does rhubarb look like when you grow it?
It grows low to the ground, and it's looks like a small bush with large elephant ear-shaped leaves. And the chefs, they like the rhubarb types that have the bright red stalks. They want a lot of color.
Yeah, I've seen the stalk sold in stores, but I didn't know what the entire plant looked like or where those stalks came from.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. It's a very easy to grow crop, even in the home, even in your home, because it's a perennial. You just plant it once and you can harvest it, 10 or 20 years.
Right. Okay, well, this is just fascinating. And what we're talking about now is the Lean Farm Guide to Growing Vegetables, but you had a book previous to this that is kind of goes along with it, right?
Uh-huh. My first book is just called Lean Farm, and that talks about the lean system in general terms and explains it in such a way that farmers can, I think, wrap their minds around it. And then I give examples of how, we applied lean in some cases on our farm. And then the new book, which is coming out just a week ago, is called The Lean Farm Guide to Growing Vegetables. And this one gives you detailed information on how to grow crops, whether you're a home gardener or a market grower. I tell you everything I've learned the last 15 years. And it's the book I wish that had been available when I began.
You talk in the book about how most of your customers you try and keep within a 10-mile radius, and that also helps keep your system lean because you're not wasting money on travel. And That's really the way all farms should operate. Shouldn't we have farms near the population and working together?
It's actually the way that all farms used to operate. It's only been in the last two or three generations that we've kind of gotten used to this idea that we can ship our food across the world to whoever wants to pay enough to eat it. And the reality is, within 100 miles of just about anywhere in the U.S., you can grow such a wide range of crops. If you want to start a career as a small scale farmer, there's really no reason to look very far from home. And I say keep your food as close to home as possible.
Those are great messages. Ben Hartman, thank you so much for joining me today. I loved reading your book. Thank you for creating this system that is going to be so helpful to so many people.
Hey, thank you for having me. Thank you.
You're welcome. Ben Hartman, The Lean Farm Guide to Growing Vegetables, published by Chelsea Green, one of my favorite publishers. Well, that wraps up another It's All About Food show. I'm so glad you joined me. And remember, if you're still thinking about plant-powered and thriving, we start tonight. Go to thriving.foodrevolution.org/join. I'm Karen Hartglass. Thanks for joining me on It's All About Food. Have a delicious week.